Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on in the week, I got an update from John Pontifex of Aid to the Church in Need. He was giving us an update, for once good news, in relation to a Pakistani girl who had been abducted. He told us the story of Farah Shaheen.
A 12-year-old Pakistani Christian girl, was abducted from her home in Faisalabad in the Punjab province of Pakistan. And she went missing, and her father, Azif Masi, begged the police to try to get her back. And after 6 months, in December, the police finally uncovered her whereabouts, went into the home of her abductor, and they found that she had been shackled hand and foot, so we were told. There were wounds to her hands and more particularly her feet. And Farah herself was very traumatized, as you would expect of a 12-year-old or indeed anyone in that situation. And it turned out after a period of time of gradually her telling the story that she had been, had a chain attached to her and that she was forced to clear filth on a daily basis from a nearby cattle yard. She had been forcibly married to her abductor, and there were reports that she'd been subjected to gang rape. So you can only but imagine the distress that this caused. It's not unusual, sadly, for Christian and other minority faith girls to be abducted in this way. But for somebody who was so young, age 12, and to have suffered this enslavement, including with chains, and shackles, was particularly egregious, particularly painful. And there were also great concerns at the slow response of the authorities, of the police, to recognise the gravity of what had happened and the need to try and track her down. It took a full 6 months, and that's caused a lot of hurt and a lot of disappointment among the Christian community.
So what is going to happen next then? What's the reaction been, and what will happen with the family and with Farah?
She is undergoing psychological treatment at the moment. Obviously, the trauma is such that she has got a lot of time needed for her to work through her experiences. She's gradually coming to terms with what she went through. I have seen pictures of her showing her joy, her elation. And I was surprised when I saw some of the video material that the support group of Farah were able to release, showing how natural she looked, because the reports I'd received up until then showed the distress and the trauma to be very marked in her, in terms of her behaviour. But she seems now to be able to begin to work through what she went through. And the hope is that she will soon be able to resume her studies. She is only 12, of course. And she's obviously got the support of her brothers, her many brothers and sisters, and they will, I'm sure, together as a family, be working to enable her to put this terrible experience behind her and to start again. And of course, really what's needed is that the person who abducted Farah needs to be brought to justice. And it seems that we're a long way before achieving that. We know that the absence of justice in this case means that there's no deterrent for people in future to do something of the same. And given how widespread this is, we're very, very anxious about the degree to which young girls, particularly minority faith girls, be it Christians, be it Hindus, be it other minority faiths, are at risk of the same thing happening, be it rape, be it enslavement, be it trafficking, or simply being turned into a prostitute working for some criminal gang. And in the UK, we're working still on this great plan to win asylum for another Pakistani Christian girl called Mara Shaba, who was abducted in similar circumstances, not dissimilar to Farah, who eventually was able to escape from her abductor and who's now been receiving death threats after being accused of apostasy, which is a crime that's punishable by death, according to the hardliners in Pakistan. And because of that, we have appealed to Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister here in the UK, calling for him to give her, Mara, and her family asylum. And we have 12,000 or more signatures to a petition calling for that outcome. This petition has now gone before the Home Secretary, Priti Patel. We have an open letter signed by 30 or more bishops, parliamentarians and others, all calling for Mara to be given asylum. And this we are fighting as much for Mara as for the many, many other girls in Pakistan who suffered in this way, because it's time that forced conversion for and abductions and the appalling crimes committed against young girls in Pakistan be brought to an end.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
With the new changes proposed for what will happen for Leaving Cert students this year, how will it work in practical terms? How will the algorithm work for predicted grades? And also, what are the crucial dates that students need to think of? These are some of the issues that I talked with the education editor of the Irish Independent, Catherine Donnelly, about recently. And she started off just talking about the year that Leaving Cert students have had so far.
Well, we know obviously that this year's Leaving Cert class have had a difficult 2 years in school. They missed out many weeks of in-school classes last year. They were back in the autumn, but they haven't been back in school since Christmas. The Irish Second Level Students Union, at the start of this year, after Christmas, they did a survey of members, following which they made a very clear request to the government for choice. They wanted options around receiving both a version of last year's calculated grades and doing the exams. So they've spent several weeks in negotiations, and last week we got the deal that had been reached. And what it allows every student to receive what this year is being called an accredited grade. It'll be a sort of a version of last year's calculated grade, but an accredited grade. So that will be based on the teacher's estimated mark for a student in all subjects. And that will go through a national standardisation process, as happened last year, and I'll come back to that in a moment. As well as that, students may also sit exams in any or all subjects in June. So in many ways, they've had a difficult 2 years, but they're now getting the best of both worlds in that they can they'll receive their accredited grades, and they may also sit the exams if they want to, but they don't have to. And for students sitting the exams, they will also do orals and practicals that will be assessed by an external examiner. They may be done in school by perhaps their own teacher, or might be a teacher exchange maybe from another local school. They'll be recorded, but they will be assessed by an external examiner.
So, and what does that mean, Catherine? Yeah. Just in terms of the choice of, that they can take their calculated grade or they can sit exams, can students choose to say, okay, well, I'll take the calculated grade for this subject, but I really want to sit a particular exam? Can they pick and choose that way?
They can pick and choose. As I say, it's a win-win for them. They can pick and choose. So they may decide that they're happy to rely on the teacher grades in five subjects, but they're going to sit two or three. It'll be entirely up to them. And they'll have opportunities to start making those decisions from the 8th of March. I'm sure they'll be guided by teachers and guidance counsellors in their schools. So it really is like, when you try to think about what are the negatives, like there's no negatives there. They have a backup. They can do the exams and they can receive grades. They can do both. And they will get the better of the two results in any subject where they get both a grade and an exam. So for argument's sake, Wendy, let's say you decided to do English and maths in the exams, but that you were going to just stick with the teacher grades for all your other subjects. And let's say in school you received a H2 from your teacher for both English and maths. And then you went on to sit the exams, and you actually, in the exams, you got a H1 in English, but your maths was marked back to H3, you will actually come out then with a H1 in your English, and you'll hold on to the H2 accredited grade that you got based on your teacher's mark. So you can't lose by sitting the exams. Having said that, there will be students in June, and even now maybe have feel that they've had too much disruption, and they may feel they just don't want to go into an exam hall. they may be too stressed by it. There may be students who, for health, you know, health and safety reasons, may decide in June that they do not want to be in any kind of a congregated setting. We don't know where, you know, exactly how things are going to be in June, but there may be students, as I say, who have, you know, health issues and just don't want to be in an exam hall. So they will have the benefit of their calculator.
They'll have the choice, as you say. Yeah. And what about students? I know there's been a few different surveys done of students. Do you think most of them are planning to sit the exams or sit at least one exam?
Well, it seems, I saw one survey last week where 85% of students, that was based on about 3,000 students, about 85% said that they would sit at least one exam. So we have to wait and see. So I think their guidance counsellors will be encouraging them to enter for the exams and to sit exams. But as I say, they have the choice. So I think probably we will see big numbers entering. And then maybe come June, they mightn't all turn up in the exam halls. But I think we will probably see significant numbers at this point deciding that they're going to sit them. I think that's very much what the schools will be encouraging them to do, because they've nothing to lose. As I explained to you there, if you go down, if you got a H2 in a subject in an accredited grade, except you won't know, that's the other thing, you won't know in advance.
No, of course. You have to wait and see. But so in terms of actually deciding what exam students are going to sit, they go online and there's a system. What's the closing date? When do they need to make up their mind?
I don't know what the closing date is, but they will be opening, the portal will be opening on the state exams website on the 8th of March. And they will be able to enter their choices subject by subject from the 8th of March. I don't know what the closing date is for it, but it opens on the 8th of March. That's in a couple of weeks' time. So they've time to think about it. But as I say, they've absolutely nothing to lose by deciding now that they're going to sit the exams. The teachers will be accumulating evidence on student performance up until about the middle of May for the accredited grade, and they will then submit that information to the State Exams Commission, and it will go through a process broadly similar to last year, but it won't have the... If you remember last year, there was a lot of controversy over the use of one measure, which was a school's historic record in the Leaving Cert, and there was a concern that if that was used, it was in the equation all through last summer, and at the last minute it was withdrawn, because there was a concern that if you drew up a computer algorithm and you included in it a school's past performance in a Leaving Cert, that you would disadvantage high-achieving students in disadvantaged communities where maybe the school results are a bit lower than in other schools. So it was withdrawn at the last minute. And so that won't be in the computer program this year.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
On the 5th of March, Pope Francis will make a historic trip to Iraq. He will be the first pope to visit the country. Earlier on in the week, I spoke to journalist Cullen Flynn, who's going to be going on the trip and indeed on the papal plane with Pope Francis as he flies to Iraq. Cullen started off just explaining the historic nature of this journey.
Some popes in the past have talked about going to Iraq, or they've tried to go. Pope John Paul II was the last, and he had a trip planned in 1999, but they had to cancel that at the last minute due to security concerns. Basically, the country couldn't guarantee his safety. So, of course, with the war, with the instability there in the country, it's been very difficult for a pope to go and visit. But Pope Francis has been talking about this for a long time. He has always wanted to go to Iraq. The persecution of Christians is something that's very close to his heart. And in Iraq, Christians have been persecuted for years now, and they've fled the country. So this is going to be the first apostolic trip that he has done in a while because of the pandemic, and it will be the first ever, as you said, the first ever time a pope has visited the country of Iraq. In 2 weeks, I'll be on the papal flight with a number of other reporters. We'll be going to witness this historic journey, and it'll be not a long trip. He's going to be there for just a couple of days, but he's going to try and hit a lot of the main cities. He will meet the Prime Minister, he'll meet political leaders, he'll meet some of the key Muslim leaders in the country as well, which will be a big thing for interreligious dialogue. And he's going to meet, Wendy, some of the persecuted Christians and talk to them and hear their stories as well.
It sounds like, as always with the papal visit, there's going to be a lot going on. What about your own preparations, Colm, in terms of stories you're working on? I know historically, if you're a journalist that's blessed enough to get a seat on the papal plane, that's often a time when the Pope, and Pope Francis specifically, gives a lot of exclusives, and that's often where lots of headlines and sound bites are dropped. So what are you preparing to ask him?
Well, that is a good question. And this is all new to me, how this works, because, as you know, before this, I was living in New York City and working there for RTE and the BBC. So I moved here just recently. I've never been on a papal flight before. But you're right. Normally, the Pope, he travels at the front of the plane. They charter a plane normally from the Italian airline. The Pope is up the front with all of his entourage, and then the journalists were down the back somewhere. And traditionally, during the flight, he will come back and he will go around and talk to each journalist one-on-one. Now, this is off the record. It's not a chance for you to do an interview, but he'll come and say hi, and it's your opportunity to greet the Pope, maybe give him a gift or a letter or talk to him about whatever you please. And then he would take one or two questions. But I've been told the way it works is, because there are journalists from the BBC, from NBC, from CNN, from all the big networks, that together the journalists decide on one question. So it's not like people are shouting questions and like maybe Donald Trump's press conference in the White House. It's a bit different than that.
There's a sense of real collegiality then with different networks. You're not in competition with each other. You just want to get the best out of a chat and an interview with the Pope.
Yeah, so I've been told the way it works is you get together before the flight or when the flight is taking off, and you agree together on one question to ask to the Pope. So that's the way I think it's going to work. Who gets to ask that question, I'm not sure, but I'm excited to find out.
Yeah, we look forward to hearing how you get on, of course, on the trip and on that papal plane as well, Colm. But in terms of what the visit means to Catholics in particular, and Christians, of course, give us a little bit of insight into the history in Iraq for Catholics and for Christians.
It is a very complicated and unfortunately bloody history, because I think, you know, especially since the US invasion. Now, the persecution of Christians did not begin with the US invasion, but I spoke actually just 10 minutes ago, Wendy, would you believe, I finished an interview with a guy called Alexandre Deval. He's a Frenchman, and he is one of the most well-known writers when it comes to Christianophobia, talking about the persecution of Christians. I just ran down from the TV studio to the radio studio to do this interview, and he was telling me that in the mind of many Muslims in Iraq, they see Christianity as being the religion of the imperialistic white man, as he put it. And so it's a very deeply rooted hatred they have, many of them. This is what he was telling me. And he said that with the US invasion, that they see the meddling of the West, Western countries, in the affairs of the Middle East, Eastern countries, as something that has fueled this. So the persecution of Christians has gotten worse over the years. It hasn't gotten better. There are two trains of thought about the Pope's visit. Some think this is great. It's going to be a way to bring Muslims and Christians together, to remind them that we are all brothers and sisters. The man I just interviewed, Alexandre Deval, and some others think that it may be too soft an approach to go there and to talk about brotherhood and sisterhood, when really we should be demanding that Christians are not persecuted anymore. We should be taking a harder line. So there's kind of a split among people whether this trip is a good trip at the right time, or whether maybe it's something that's a bit too soft.
And do you think Pope Francis will get to talk to the right people in order to try and advocate for Christians in Iraq?
He will get to the right people, I think, but it's all down to what he says and how he says it. And the guy I interviewed, it was fascinating. It really kind of opened my eyes to hear this, his opinions on things. He was saying, you know, if Muslims, they see the Pope coming and embracing the leaders, you know, and all the persecution that is done to Christians in the name of Islam, and if they see the Pope coming in and, you know, embracing them and acting like things are fine, it doesn't send out a good message. He said over there in that culture, they admire strength. They don't like weakness. And if they see the Pope as a weak leader, it could even go against us in our favor. But you know what? Many Christians and many Catholics are saying this is a great thing to go and talk about hope, just to be a presence there. It maybe will go and start to change the mindset of people in the country.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
There is now a published register available of registered pet sellers, but will this clamp down on puppy farms and illegal dog breeding? This is something I talked to Pete the vet about recently, and he started off just explaining how this might help to solve the problem and the issues with it in the first
place. This is all part of the battle to regulate animal sales so that animals have better lives and that consumers aren't diddled by dodgy dealers in animals. And it's like a war that's going on between those who are trying to break the law and against the interests of animals and against the interests of pet owners, and, if you like, society and government, which is trying to win that war in favour of animals and in favour of pet owners.
And do you think it will have a big difference, Pete, this particular register, in terms of lowering the number of illegal puppy trading, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a really positive step forwards. I think we need to continue to do better than this, though. I'm involved in a group called IPAG, which is the Irish Pet Advertising Advisory Group, and we're working, it's a group of different of vets and animal welfare groups who are trying to use technology to make it as difficult as possible for people to get around the systems that are in place. And so what we're looking at is improving the use of automated technology to double check that numbers are correct and they're not just invented, and to be able to follow things through in the best possible way. But it genuinely is like a war between those who want to make a fast buck and get out of there and those who are trying to bring some sort of order to a bit of a crazy system.
And Pete, like, would you say for a lot of people, you know, who end up maybe buying a dog in that way, there is a bit of, and I don't mean it in a pejorative way, but ignorance about what might be behind the story of this dog. And, you know, most people might be doing it in good faith, even though they don't know that they're actually kind of fueling such a negative part, a negative industry, really.
Yes, like a huge part of this is education of the consumer. And if people go to the IPAG website, and that's ipaag.ie, they'll see a guide to how to buy a puppy ethically. And that's really what we're trying to do. And it's not just because it's ethical. I mean, I know sometimes people, they want to pay tradesmen in cash and they want to get a good deal and they want to get a cheap puppy from somebody, all that sort of stuff. But the point is that if you do that, you're taking serious risks. And I'll tell you, the biggest risk is this. First of all, you buy a very unhealthy animal, so you pay a lot of money, and a few weeks later, it's dead because it fell sick and, you know, because it was an unhealthy animal to start with. That's the first risk. The second, more common risk, is if you buy a puppy that's not been well socialized, so you might get this pup that looks superficially okay, but maybe it looks a bit nervous or something. What we know from studies is that 1 year later, a much higher number of puppies from that sort of dodgy background has to be euthanized because it starts to bite, because it's become aggressive, because it was so poorly socialized. So you're not getting a good deal. You might think you're getting a good deal, but you really aren't. And the animals suffer at the end of it, and that's what this is all about.
Yeah, and nobody wants that, hopefully. Well, it's great that people can go onto the IPAG website, Peter, just get advice if they are thinking of buying a puppy, and also to remind people as well about rehoming dogs that are in maybe shelters, SPCA shelters or Dogs Trust, that we maybe don't talk about that enough.
No, well, that's true. I mean, that is always, I think, the number one option. You don't need to get a fluffy white puppy in order to have a great pet. There's loads of different animals make good pets, and I'd always start with a rescue centre. By the way, all rescue centres also need to be registered. If they have more than six breeding bitches, they have to register as a dog breeding establishment. Even if they're not particularly wanting to breed animals, they have to register, and they also have to register as animal sellers because they're supplying animals to people. So, you know, they're included also in this effort to regulate a slightly chaotic system.
Yeah. Finally, I wanted to ask you some good news about Ireland's first dedicated wildlife hospital. Tell us about this, Pete.
This is so exciting. There's a really enthusiastic bunch of wildlife rehabilitators in Ireland. And up till now, they've been working kind of in an ad hoc way. People with backyard sheds and so on, taking in wild animals that are injured or sick and doing their best to care for them. And there's been a network that's been developing over the last number of years. They have a great website, actually, called Irish Wildlife Matters, where they give the public great advice on how to care for any animals that you come across. But the group have now gone to the next stage, and they've managed to set up a wildlife hospital, a national wildlife hospital. This is something that they've been working towards for a number of years. It's been a long-term plan. And it's one of the possibly benefits of COVID is that somebody who runs a pub north of Dublin in the countryside there, they had stable areas and they had big meeting rooms, and it wasn't being used because of COVID, and so they offered it to the wildlife enthusiasts, and it's now been set up as Ireland's first wildlife hospital. And it means that at last there's somewhere where animals can go, wild animals can go, to get the proper care that they need.
That's great news, yeah.
And so the group is called Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland, they note their website, irishwildlifematters.ie, and you can find out all sorts of things about what they're all up to. But they need money, of course, and the people care about animals. Go to their website and you can make a donation, and it's definitely a great cause.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
The Mount Sion Choir really is a good news story. Before the choir was started in the school, people didn't think it would work, yet many of the things that the choir has put together have gone viral online. And now the Mount Sion Choir is working with the Mary Keating Foundation and recently duetted with Ronan Keating, all to raise funds for that incredible cause. And recently we were chatting to Colette Kearney, who's involved with the Mount Sion Choir, and she started off just explaining how the choir began in the first place.
Our choir is set up in a school called Mount Sion CBS. We're in the heart of Waterford City here, and we're actually the first Christian Brothers school in the world. And it's set up 8 years ago. We had all these pupils around the place who loved to sing and rap, but we actually didn't have music as a subject. So we set up the choir, and the first couple of choir teachers, they didn't last too long because they said the lads were crazy and you couldn't teach them. But we persevered, and as the years went on, their confidence grew, and it kind of became like a family unit nearly in some ways, Wendy.
So you saw Colette just bringing in music and focusing on music having a huge impact on these students.
Some of them were innately wonderful at music, and many of them are in churches around Waterford where they would sing on Sundays. So what they brought actually into our choir was their knowledge. And I actually think that's what makes this story wonderful, is that the young people created this. The adults that are involved in the story, we're kind of on the outside of it, but it was the innate music ability of the kids in the choir that actually formed it. So there was no proper structure to it. It was crazy to start with, but we really feel that often the greatest creativity comes through chaos.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it, and that's what kind of spurns our creativity on. And it's lovely to hear just when those young people are given a chance to engage in that creativity, they kind of took the challenge on.
They took it on and they ran with it, and people seemed to love the story as they were watching it as we went along. So we put little clips up on social media, and then 2 years ago, this one clip of Shallow of Christopher and Jessica from our choir singing, that went completely viral. So that had over 100 million views, and then that brought us on the next part of the journey. So it's as if we're on this remarkable journey that people have come along with us.
Yeah, and they're watching you as you all grow together. So tell us a little bit about how the opportunity arose then, Colette, for the choir to duet with Ronan Keating.
Well, following on from Shallow, we were supposed to go to sing in Carnegie Hall, and over New York, we fundraised for a year and a half, because you have to remember, we're an inner city school, we don't have much money, and we gave all our a year and a half fundraising to get us to Carnegie Hall. Obviously, COVID came along, all our dreams
were gone. That must have been so disappointing for everybody.
They were devastated, yeah. Because you know, when you've worked that hard for something, and it took us so long to actually raise the money to go, and you know, our flights were booked, our hotel was booked, everything was going to happen. It was June of last year. But what I loved the most about them is that they didn't feel sorry for themselves. They did initially, but then they kind of said, look at Miss, this has happened, so be it. We're going to pick ourselves up, and what can we do next for our community? So we went on a Zoom coffee morning for the Marie Keating Foundation. It was held by a remarkable man called John Wall. And on the Zoom coffee morning, we offered to do a Facebook live show, because that's all that we could kind of do during lockdown was do a Facebook Live show. And from that seed of an idea came then Concert for Cancer, which was on Virgin Media last summer, and it raised €500,000 for the Marie Keating Foundation.
Wow, that's incredible. And I love how it's kind of oblique thinking. It starts as one idea and then it ends up somewhere else.
Well, Wendy, this is what I'm saying about the chaos of us.
This is
a typical example of something that started really small and ended up in a massive journey in a completely different direction. And that's how we got connected then with Ronan.
So what happened next then? Obviously, it's probably worked out again a totally different way, given that we're still in the middle of this pandemic. So how did you do the kind of technical side of things and bring it all together?
Our greatest challenge was to try to get the kids together without them singing close to each other. So we recorded the single in our chapel here. We have a beautiful chapel on our school grounds. And actually Edmund Rice's tomb is in the chapel. And we just brought in the choir in small little groups. We put the tech part together here, and then Ronan put his side together in London. And then some geniuses then put it together in the track that you've seen. And the video is the most beautiful showcase, I think, for the Irish countryside. It was recorded in Curramore Estate, which is just outside Waterford. And there's beautiful drone footage of this gorgeous estate and the choir in the middle of the estate. And then Ronan is on a big screen.
Wow, it's amazing really how technology has brought it together. And please God, they'll one day in the not too distant future be able to a real live duet at Ronan Keating. Do you think that might end up happening?
A poor Ronan, we are going to make that happen. We are absolutely determined.
That's your mission, Colette, now, yeah.
That's our new mission. It's just Ronan doesn't know it yet, but now it's out there.
So in terms of, you recorded the song, you explained that and how it worked all virtually. What's been the reaction so far?
What's happened is, I think it's given a voice to young people in a pandemic. So here's this group of young people that their dreams are initially dashed. Then they've taken on this great project, but it's brought in all these people, their lives have been touched by cancer, and we've gotten an awful lot of messages from people who are living with cancer, or maybe they've lost somebody to cancer, and it's just focused the minds of people, I think, to a positive good news story and a wonderful charity in the Marie Keating Foundation, because they do incredible work.
Yeah, and just as you say, it's kind of had a few different impacts, Colette, which is incredible. Just that, you know, they obviously raising money for a fantastic charity, the Marie Keating Foundation, but also, as you say, giving a voice to young people who might have felt a bit voiceless over the last nearly a year now. So the practical side of things, when is the single being released and how can we support this incredible piece of art you put together?
Two ways that you can support us. We would love to get this into the charts. So on the 5th of March, that is the release date, and it's going to be available on all musical platforms. And then there's a financial way that you could support the foundation. There are CDs for sale through the mariekeating.ie website, and it's €10 for a CD, and we're promoting it for Mother's Day. So for a tenner, you can get your own CD sent to your mum or to your loved person, and, you know, they'll have a little record of this.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.